Tonight is Rothbardian analysis of government expenditure, and the one reading that I put on is a really good terse economic analysis of government expenditures. It's a way of thinking about the effects of government spending. And Rothbard was one of the best of all the Austrians in doing this type of analysis in understanding public finance in general and explaining it in really straightforward English. And informed by good, solid economic theory, and of course, the first thing he does is to refer to one of the main points that was made by Franz Oppenheimer in his book *The State* that I've mentioned before about the centuries-old idea that there's only two ways to make money: one is to produce goods and services for your fellow man, and the other is to use the powers of the state in some way to transfer money out of the pocket of one group of citizens into another group, presumably including yourself. And so you can engage in legal plunder, as Friedrich Bastiat called it, or you can engage in productive activities that people actually benefit enough from that they will voluntarily give you money for, which are the two ways to make money. And of course, this chapter is all about the one way, the government way of making money. And then, of course, it couldn't be more relevant to his discussion of subsidies, government subsidies today, because it seems as though everyone under the sun is being subsidized with all these so-called stimulus spending and quantitative easing and so forth. And, of course, Rothbard can't touch on every type of subsidy. There are hundreds, if not thousands, but he gives a good overview of the basic analysis, I think, of subsidies. And basically, you would not find any disagreement with what he says initially here by someone like Milton Friedman or a Chicago school economist, where he says that basically when the government subsidizes some activity, they are basically taking money away from the efficient people and giving it to inefficient people, because people always spend their own money, their own hard-earned dollars, more efficiently than people who are spending money that is not their own, that is the taxpayer's money taken from somebody else. In today's world, this is called fairness or social justice, to take money by force away from the efficient and give it to the inefficient. In fact, years ago, my first book that was co-authored with James Bennett was entitled Underground Government, the Off-Budget Public Sector. And one of the things we did in there, as I recall, well, I did some digging around to Small Business Administration loan programs and found that in order to qualify for a Small Business Administration loan at that period of time, anyway, this was the early 80s, you had to prove that you had been turned down, your business had been turned down by at least three banks. So you had to have at least three expert financial institutions tell you that in their judgment, your business plan was a loser to qualify for a subsidy. So by definition, a lot of government subsidies are subsidizing proven losers. I guess a great example is the company that's been in the news, the national news in the U.S. in the last couple of weeks, the Green Job Company that was making solar panels that reportedly had already lost $500 million and was a proven loser. So the Obama administration gave them another $500 million in tax dollars, and they blew through that, and now they're bankrupt. That's a classic example of government subsidies. Really, government subsidies to corporations or businesses of any sort is really an attack on capitalism, Rothbard says. He doesn't use those exact words, but I think you have to understand what lies behind what he's saying here, in that the story goes that at one time Ludwig von Mises was asked, what is the one distinguishing feature of a capitalist economy? If you were to pick one thing that distinguishes a capitalist economy from a non-capitalist economy, what is it? And he said, well-functioning capital markets. And, of course, what he meant by that is that when we teach economics and we learn economics and we hear that markets, the free markets, tend to allocate resources to their most highly valued uses, that is, the most highly valued by consumers, capital markets is how this happens. If you have an industry that is outdated, for example, then consumers will no longer patronize that industry, and the capital and labor and other resources that were used in that industry will be bid away in by other industries that produce goods and services that people do want. And the capital markets facilitate that. There'll be a depreciation of the capital in that one use, and there'll be investment, new investment in the new types of capital, so that the whole structure of capital in the economy will be transformed away from the old uses, which consumers no longer value very highly, if at all, to the new uses. And so in order to have a well-functioning capitalist economy, we have to have reasonably well-functioning capital markets. Subsidies or bailouts, as we call them today, put a wrench in the whole works, because they take a look at the failing companies or the failing industries, the outdated companies, outdated industries, and say, hold on, we are not going to allow this capital reallocation process to work its way in the market. We're going to subsidize you to stay in business. It would be as though when the automobile was invented, if the government were to continue subsidizing the buggy whip manufacturing business, even though hardly anyone was buying buggy whips anymore once they started riding in automobiles. And so it slows down and hinders the whole capitalist process, and as a result, it makes all of us poorer, because it keeps capital stuck in these old industries that aren't very lucrative. An example of this that comes to mind that is very egregious was England in the 1970s, where the British government under the Labour Party for decades had been engaging in corporate welfare, as we call it, bailouts of nationalized industries in England. And so they were horribly inefficient, but the government kept pouring millions and millions of pounds, British pounds, after them. And this became known as the British disease, the lethargic inefficiency of these British companies was known worldwide as the British disease, and many of those companies were eventually privatized during the Thatcher years in England. So that's the second point that is important here about prolonging the life of inefficient enterprises. And this, of course, is what the bailouts are about. It's what the quantitative easing by the Fed is about. They're attempting to prolong the life of the real estate market as long as they can, to prop up real estate prices. They're failing at it fairly well, but that's what they're trying to do. A third point that Rothbard makes is that when you go this route, when you grant government subsidies, what you're doing is you're substituting, or you're encouraging, rent-seeking activity or plunder-seeking activity at the expense of profit-seeking activity. If there are no subsidies and no possibility for subsidies, then the only way to make money is producing goods and services for your fellow man. Getting back to the state by Franz Oppenheimer. And so you have to stick to your knitting. You have to develop skills and knowledge and experience in working with other people to produce goods and services that are valued by customers. But with the introduction of subsidies, people will spend less time doing that and more time acquiring skills that are used to influence the government. Lobbying skills, law degrees rather than engineering degrees at the universities, and so forth. And so the more subsidies from the government we have in a society, the more plunder seeking we'll have. That is, the more lobbying the government to rob the taxpayers and to use the money to give to your group, your industry, your union, whoever, General Motors, whoever might be the subsidized recipient from the government. And the economic angle here is that the opportunity cost, or the cost foregone of all this rent-seeking activity, is the goods and services that were never produced. Since you're not spending the time producing those things, you're spending the time at the state legislature or the national capital, Washington, D.C., in the U.S., lobbying politicians to rob your neighbors. By definition, you're not spending time back at the office, back at the factory, producing goods and services. And so, again, we're all impoverished in general. The greater is the volume of subsidies in an economy. The subsidies for poverty also increase poverty. Rothbard has a nice short discussion of what economists call the moral hazard problem. The idea here with poverty, of course, the moral hazard has nothing to do with morality in a religious sense, per se. But the hazard is that when you pay people for not working, which is what welfare is, well, it should be no surprise that at some point you encourage them to not work. And if you encourage them to not work, you encourage them to remain in poverty, because that's really the only cure for poverty is work and production. If you can look at people who receive government benefits, and if they receive $40,000 a year in government benefits, you can declare that they are not in poverty anymore. But if you take away the benefits, they would be in poverty. So to genuinely get out of poverty requires production and work and entrepreneurship. And of course, the moral hazard problem of the welfare state is that if it gets too generous, it pays people not to work, and people are said to be trapped in welfare, because if they do take that first job, they are forced to give up a lot of their welfare benefits. The economist James Gortney, who's the co-author of a very widely used economics textbook, which is a very good textbook, by the way. It's probably the best or one of the best mainstream economics textbooks. James Gortney, Richard Stroop, and I think they have a third author now. It's been around since the late 70s, Principles of Economics book. Anyway, Stroop in his research, one of the things he's known for way back when, years ago, is calculating what's called the marginal tax rate applied to people in poverty. And it's not really a tax. They don't pay taxes as income earners would, but the tax is the withdrawal of government benefits as you take a job. And at the time he was doing this, as I recall, he said that the marginal tax rate was about 70%. 70% for people on welfare, meaning on average for every $1 you earn in that first job, you lose 70 cents worth of welfare benefits of various kinds, child care allowances, hospital allowances, housing subsidies, and so forth, because that's how the system works. And so therefore, you couldn't blame a lot of people for not taking that first job. It just doesn't pay to do that. So we have trapped generations of people in poverty, and that's what Rothbard is talking about in this chapter. Another more subtle point that Rothbard makes about these types of subsidies, welfare in particular, is that they crowd out private effort. A great explanation of this, a great book on this, is by Charles Murray, and the book is entitled In Pursuit. The subtitle is Of Happiness and Good Government. And there's a chapter or two in there of the crowding out effect of government programs. For example, he argues that with the government schools, the so-called public schools, over the years they induce parents, many parents anyway, maybe probably most, to think that the government is taking care of my child's education, therefore I don't need to do much about it. And so therefore, if the government fails at it, then the children are left with a poor or non-existent education. If the government says, we will take care of your parents and grandparents in their old age, don't worry about it with Social Security, people will do less to help themselves, and people will do less to help their parents and grandparents, thinking the government will take care of it with Medicare and Social Security and so forth. And then when the government programs fail, as they inevitably do, then the retirees are left with inadequate income and inadequate health care and other problems. With welfare, the government says, don't bother taking care of the families in your neighborhood who are in need of food assistance. We will take care of them. Then when the government fails or does a poor job of it, as it usually does, then the families in your neighborhood who are genuinely on hard times are left with nothing. And so we can see over time that with the introduction of the welfare state, we see fewer and fewer of the type of genuinely voluntary efforts to address a lot of these problems, and charities, churches, and nonprofit organizations of all kinds usually do a much better job than government bureaucracies in Washington, D.C. in dealing with all of these things. Now, the American welfare state is similar to most other welfare states in that the government itself does not directly administer the programs, and so the government itself has created in the U.S. thousands of so-called nonprofit organizations that administer the welfare state, but they are government funded. at least in part. They raised donations, private donations also, but they also get a heavy dose of tax dollars. Catholic Charities, for example, is known to get more than half of all of its money from taxes from government. And so you don't have really genuine philanthropic activity in these organizations. For example, with Catholic Charities, they are prohibited from trying to teach religion or teach Catholicism to the recipients of their works, feeding the hungry and so forth, because of the hysteria over the separation of church and state that we have in America. And so they're forced into giving up on what they claim is their fundamental purpose, religion, in order to take government money. And so there's a crowding out effect of private charity that happens. Okay, I'm reading the chat here. I'm just seeing what's going on. Just give one person and the video's not working. So, okay, I think the rest of you can hear it. I guess it's just people who are just signing on. Another example of this moral hazard effect that Rothbard talks about is unemployment insurance. He doesn't call it unemployment insurance. I think he calls it a subsidy for non-work or something like that. But unemployment insurance, which now has been extended to almost 2 years in the United States, if you tell people that we will pay you on average about 60% of what you were making in your job for 2 years, a lot of people will take that as kind of a nice vacation, and they won't search for a new job as hard as they otherwise would have. They won't learn new skills, get more of an education, which is what they have to do in order to move forward in their lives economically, and so they'll take a nice vacation. So unemployment insurance actually creates more unemployment by increasing the duration of unemployment. After all, that is part of the ingredient of the measurement of what the government calls the unemployment rate. It's how many weeks on average a person is unemployed. If that increases from, say, 6 weeks to 16 weeks, then the overall unemployment rate, as reported by the government, by the U.S. Department of Labor in the U.S., will be higher. And so unemployment insurance encourages people to remain unemployed for a longer period of time. Rothbard also discusses the notion of free public services. And, of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch. What the free public library or the free public schools are is schools and libraries that have hidden prices. The prices or the costs are hidden in taxes. We pay property taxes for the most part in the U.S. to finance so-called public schools. And of course, you have free health care somewhere, and so like in Canada, it's not free. It's actually very costly. But you just pay for it through taxes as opposed to paying for it when you receive the service. And there's also a moral hazard effect that is attached to so-called free public services. And health care is a good example. In countries like England and Canada, that have nationalized health care, or health care for all, as they call it, well, you create a situation of where there's a zero price at the point of purchase of the service. And so at a zero price, any freshman student of economics would understand that the demand will be all but infinite. And so if demand is infinite because it's free, that's going to drive up costs. And so the costs will go up through the roof. And if the costs go up through the roof, the government will then step in and say, we have to do something about this. It's getting much too costly to have health care. And what they're most likely to do is to impose price controls. They'll have a system of fees for a day in a hospital, for what doctors can charge for different procedures and so forth. They won't call it price controls. They'll call it budget controls or something like that, but they're price controls. And what we know about price controls is that you stimulate the amount demanded by the consumer. If you push the price down, consumers always want more of anything, including healthcare, if it's cheaper. And at the same time, you take some of the profitability out of supplying it. Okay. And so if you take some of the profitability out of supplying it, you're going to have a shortage. And so you create shortages. And then the government has to decide how to allocate the shortage. In England, I know they use first come, first serve. So there are long waiting lines. The same thing in Canada. There are just long lines for various medical procedures. And you can go online and you can read go up to the Fraser Institute website. I think it's probably, you just Google Fraser Institute, F-R-A-S-E-R. And every year they publish a publication called on waiting lists in Canada, hospital waiting lists in Canada, which are much higher than they are in the United States. There hardly is any waiting in the United States for heart surgery and things like that. But there is in Canada because of price controls, and there has been for many decades in England also because of price controls on health care. And so but of course that empowers the government even more. Government creates all these problems, first by nationalizing the industry, then by stimulating demand with zero pricing, and then by creating shortages of price controls, and then by devising some allocation scheme that creates chaos. That's why Rothbard says in this chapter that whenever government takes over any enterprise, it creates another island of chaos, and that certainly is true in the healthcare field. And of course, in the United States, healthcare is probably by far the most heavily regulated industry, even without Obamacare. So one mistake a lot of people make is to think that, well, we've got this great free market system, but it has some flaws. It doesn't cover everybody. Not true. What would you call Medicare and Medicaid, for example? These are big elements of the welfare state with regard to healthcare. And so there already is a lot of government control over healthcare. There has been for many decades. Okay. Another aspect of government spending is that the greater the role of government in granting subsidies, the greater the degree of substitution of political whim for consumer sovereignty. In a free market, the consumer is king in the long run. You can't stay in business if you don't ultimately please consumers at least as well as your competitors do. But when you grant subsidies, government subsidies, the subsidies are decided by political preferences, political whim. If the Obama administration wants to subsidize green job companies, even though they are horrific money losers, so be it. They take money away from productive people and give it to these unproductive money losers. And so that's what they do. In the Bush administration, they declared they were in favor of an ownership society, so they favored subsidies to real estate in various ways. And that didn't work out too well, did it? Like last week, Rothbard also takes on the notion of business-like government in this chapter and makes the essential point that no government agency can ever be business-like, no matter how you dress it up. You can put a corporate CEO in charge, you can create a board of directors, and so forth. They can all be experienced business people, but they still have the power to coercively extract tax dollars from the taxpayers to pay for their expenses if they're a part of the government. No genuinely private business in a free market can do that. And therefore, no government enterprise can ever be business-like. You can call it business-like all you want, but that does not make it business-like. You can dress it up to make it look like it. And of course, that begs the whole question, doesn't it? If it's really desirable for government to be business-like, why not take this government enterprise and privatize it? Why not sell it off, auction it off to see who buys it, if anybody? Now, that's the only way to make a government enterprise business-like, is to turn it into a business and see if someone would raise enough money to buy it and run it as a private business. Of course, much of government does is totally useless crap that no one ever wanted, and it's just an excuse for politically connected people to make a lot of money and then use a lot of the money to finance the political careers of the people who gave them the subsidies. And so a lot of the government's so-called enterprises would never be purchased by anyone. as far as that's concerned. They'd be better off just junking them all, turning them into museums, like they have done with all those Lenin statues in Russia. Maybe the Pentagon will be like that someday. Another point that Rothbard makes here, it was the same point he made last week, is that probably the most important difference between a government enterprise and a private enterprise is that there are no profit and loss statements in an accounting sense in government. There are only budgets. There are no profit and loss statements. And what that means is there is no way possible for government to know whether what it's doing is efficient or inefficient, or for anyone else to know what government is doing is efficient or inefficient. All we know is it has budgets. We can do studies, and many people have, of how many dollars are used, for example, to produce a service like garbage collection by government versus the private sector, private firms. We can do comparisons like that. But really what the profit and loss statements do is if you earn a profit, it tells you that you took X dollars of resources and turned them into some product or service that is worth more than X dollars, because people paid you more than what you paid out for the inputs, for these and the resources. That's what a profit tells you. And a loss tells you that you got X dollars worth of resources and turned them into products that could not sell sufficiently, so that the value of what you sold is actually worth less than the X dollars you spent on the inputs and the resources to make the product. And so and there's no way for the government to know if it's doing things efficiently or not. Another aspect of what Rothbard writes here, too, is that whatever governments do tend to be imperialistic, and they often wait for private enterprises to get involved in some endeavor, and then if the endeavor is popular, they horn in, they step in and monopolize it and crowd out the private sector, because it's hard to compete with an entity that has all of its capital costs and all of its labor costs, for example, paid for by coerced tax dollars, whereas you, as a private business person, has to raise money from investors or use retained earnings from your sales to keep your business going. And so in case after case after case, government comes in, and if they don't just establish a legal monopoly and declare themselves a monopoly by law, they use unfair competition. They subsidize themselves. They'll impose laws and regulations on private businesses that they, in the same business, really, don't have to comply with. Whether it's minimum wage laws or environmental laws and so forth, they often exempt themselves. And I did a study of the Tennessee Valley Authority some years ago. I found that at the time I did the study, as a government-subsidized enterprise, it was exempted from all kinds of environmental laws that private power plants had to comply with. I don't know if that's still true today, but it was true at the time when I did the study. And so it crowds out private enterprises with unfair competition. So Rothbard is right on the money on that. And then there's the employee side. If you look at the politicization of society that comes with more and more government enterprises, more and more subsidies, then people in their careers, in their careers as workers, will tend to try to acquire more and more political skills, because that's how to get ahead in a government bureaucracy, political skills, and less real skills in producing goods and services that people actually value. So the more politicized the society is, the more prevalent are government enterprises, the more you'll see college students seeking degrees in political science and public administration and pre-law and things like that, at the expense of fewer students in electrical engineering and engineering of other sorts, in business and manufacturing and things like that. And of course, that's another thing that in the long run makes us all poorer, if people are engaged more and more in rent-seeking activities than productive activities. Another important point that Rothbard makes that's worth commenting on is that when you think about the market, a market is basically, even a corporation, is basically a group of people who are cooperating together to coordinate their plans. I see John says defined rent seeking, which I did earlier. It's using lobbying activities to acquire an income transfer via the state. That's what rent seeking is. But the market is generally an island of cooperation. If you look at the most simple thing like a steak that's in a grocery store, and think about it, it required, there's a rancher out there raising cattle. There are people who are supplying him with natural gas so he can heat the water that the cattle have to drink in the wintertime. He's buying hay from the farmer in the next county over to feed his cows because he doesn't have enough hay on his own farm for his cows. And he ships the cows to a meat processing plant, and all the people who are involved in the meat processing plant earn a living by processing the meat and shipping it out, and then the truck driver drives the frozen steaks across the country and delivers them to your grocery store. So you might have hundreds, if not thousands, of people cooperating, working together to make sure that your steak is sitting right there in the grocery store in your neighborhood. And that really is the essence of the market. It's called the division of labor. It's what makes the economic world work. And it's cooperative. It's not conflictual. Politics, on the other hand, is by its nature conflictual because of the nature of majority rule democracy. Just look at the perpetual conflicts we have over public schools. Prayer in the public school. If you happen to live in Utah, you might have a lot of public schools, government schools that allow silent prayer or something like that. But if you live in a more liberal state, so-called, like Massachusetts, there's no way that's going to happen. But if you have a private school, you can have a private school that simply announces, we pray every day in school. If you want your child to pray every day in school, come here. And you're free to do so. And so it's just the nature of government is that the majority rule democracy requires perpetual conflict because the majority is always seeking to plunder its way through the minority, the political minority. That's what democracy is. It really is organized thuggery dressed up in polite language, organized theft. And so that's the point that Rothbard is making here when he talks about conflict in politics and in government. Another kind of interesting point is that Rothbard makes is that the government always gets involved in monopolizing what he calls the command posts of the economy. And this would include the police, the military, the courts, the money supply, the highways, the post office, the seacoasts, because the government is always all about controlling us. It doesn't do this to serve us. It does this to control us, to make sure we only travel where the government wants us to travel. We only use its money. We are pushed around by its courts. The military does what it wants to do. The police don't necessarily protect us all the time, and so forth. And then there's the awful post office. So it can censor our communication through the post office. Keep an eye on us, Big Brother. Okay. Another interesting aspect of the discussion here that Rothbard doesn't spend that much time on is he says that it's a sort of relatively neglected area by economists in that the role of government in lending, in government government lending of money. So the government intervention into capital markets, in other words. And of course, the government is involved in hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars a year, in such things as government loans, low-interest subsidized loans. And the subsidy comes, by the way, usually in terms of a lower interest rate than you could get on the market from a bank. Or government-guaranteed loans. The student loans, for example, are guaranteed by the government, meaning If you personally do not pay off the loan, the government guarantees the lender, the bank, that the taxpayers will be on the hook for it, and they will pay off the loan. And so as a result, there's no risk to the lender, and the lender will charge a lower interest rate for that. And it's a way of subsidizing people indirectly. But the economics of this is that for every $1 billion the government directs through such lending practices, it's $1 billion that is not used by private enterprises, private homeowners, small businesses, whoever, whoever would have borrowed that money on the capital markets. There's an opportunity cost to every activity in the market, and for every $1 billion the government directs through regulation or mandates in one direction, by definition, cannot go in any other direction. The same $1 billion cannot be spent in two ways by two people. And so that's another way in which the government crowds out private capital markets and subsidizes the politically influential, who are usually not the most economically efficient. And so therefore, and once again, this is a thing that impoverishes all of us, even though it's always done in the name of the opposite. Student loans, for example, education is said to benefit all of society because it leads to a more productive labor force, and a more productive labor force leads to higher wealth creation in the long run. But of course, the primary benefit of that education, or beneficiary of that education, is the educated person. And therefore, the educated person has every incentive to acquire the resource, the financial resources to get that education without a subsidy, paying full price, in other words. Okay, so so that's another aspect of government intervention in terms of subsidies that Rothbard talks about that I think he's right on there. And this old book of mine that I mentioned, Underground Government, the off-budget public sector, has several chapters on government intervention in capital markets. And I think there's another book, an old book, 20 years old or so, if anyone happens to be interested in this, by an author named Dennis Ippolito, I-P-P-O-L-I-T-O. And the title of the book is Hidden Spending. And it's about government involvement in capital markets. And this is all relevant to the current economic crisis, of course, because in my book, Underground Government, and in this other book, Hidden Spending, it came out close to the same time. At the time, we criticized the so-called government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae. So this was the early 80s that my co-author Jim Bennett and I were warning that these are inevitably sort of inefficiency-producing organizations that are going to create big problems. So did Dennis Ippolito, and it doesn't take a genius to figure that out, because they were just subsidizing a lot of bad investments that no one else would touch even back then. And you know, they did orders of magnitude more in the last 10 years, sort of thing. Okay, and of course, all of this subsidies to education is the main source of the inflation in higher education. Because it creates a moral hazard problem similar to the type I mentioned earlier. And the government makes it cheaper for students to enroll by giving them subsidized loans. It drives up the demand for higher education, and the universities take that as a signal that they can increase the price. They increase the price. Parents demand higher limits on student loans. Congress complies. They increase the limit from, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 per loan, for example. So the loan amounts go up. That fuels even more demand for higher education. The universities understand, well, we can increase our prices by a third now because the student loan amounts have gone up by a third. So they increase the price. Parents respond, the next generation of parents respond, by demanding higher limits on the student loans. Congress complies, and it's one big cycle that pushes up the price of higher education, so that even mediocre schools today charge $30,000 to $40,000 a year and more for a college education, and many of the degree programs, of course, are useless in higher education today. And so that's the main point there about lending that I would want to make. On the topic of democracy, Rothbard has some interesting comments here on democracy in general. He makes a point that's similar to a point that Friedrich Hayek makes in The Road to Serfdom, that democracy can't really exist under socialism. So under a system of socialism, which seeks to impose one national plan on the economy, you can't allow dissent. You can't allow dissenters, and by definition, democracy, you can't vote out the plan. You have to impose the plan to make the socialism work. So that's not going to work. And he points out what a mockery that the standard classical theory of democracy is if you compare it to democracy in the real world. I think I mentioned this before in the class in passing, but in the United States, for example, if you were to Google congressional incumbent reelection rates, you'll find that for the past 50 years, it's been around 95%. So the congressional incumbents have rigged the system pretty well so that there's almost no turnover. Every once in a while, there's a little more turnover, like in the last election when the so-called Tea Party movement was so successful. The incumbent reelection rate was still around 80% or more, which is pretty high. And so I think George Smith found my old underground government book on Amazon there. I know it on the chat. And so, the classical theory of democracy sort of models democracy as a competitive business, where if one politician doesn't do a good job, a challenger will move in, will hold an election, will throw the rascals out, bring the new people in. Well, Congress has a system rigged through such things as gerrymandering, where they draw the congressional districts in such a way that if it's a Republican district, that means there might be 70 or 80% Republican voters in that district, and so a Republican will always be elected. And there are also Democratic districts that are drawn that are the same thing. There might be 70 or 80% of all the voters are known Democrats. And so no matter who the candidates are, the Democrat is going to be elected in that district. And it doesn't take, it's not very difficult for incumbents to maintain lifetime tenure in that regard. Rothbard touches briefly on what we call log rolling. He doesn't really give an example, doesn't go through it that much. But in passing, the concept of log rolling, and I'll see if I can give a verbal example of log rolling. Say you had three sets of voters, equal number of voters, 100, 100, and 100 in a small community, and you had two propositions you're voting on. You want to vote, should we raise local taxes to spend more money on schools, proposition one. Proposition two, should we raise more money to spend more money as taxes, to spend more money on hospitals, proposition two. So you might have group one that wants more money on schools, people with kids. Group two, they want more spending on hospitals. These are people, older people, who are more concerned about medical care and not, their kids are grown up, they're out of school, they don't care about school spending. And group three is satisfied with the status quo. They do not want more spending on anything. And so you could not get a majority in a situation like that because you don't have two out of three that want any one of these two things. You only have group one that wants more spending on schools. You only have group two that wants more spending on hospitals. And group three wants no more spending on anything. So if you took a vote, you could not get a majority on either school spending or hospital spending. But what log rolling is that group one can approach group two and say, listen, we don't really care at all about spending more money on hospitals, but we will hold our noses and vote for more spending on hospitals when you bring that up for a vote, if in return, you who do not care at all about more spending on schools, hold your noses also and vote for more school spending when our vote comes up. And that way the result of all this is that even though the genuine preferences of the majority of the community would be no more spending on anything, the results of the elections that are held or the referenda that are held would be more spending on everything, more spending on schools and hospitals. This is called vote trading or log rolling. And, the classical theory of democracy doesn't really make much of this. It talks about the will of the majority. But this is not the will of the majority. This is the will of a couple of minorities that have cut themselves a deal in order to get what they want the next time around, the next time their thing, whatever their thing is, comes up for a vote. And that's what log rolling is, and that's what democracy is. The final thing that Rothbard mentions is how ridiculous it is with GDP statistics, gross domestic product statistics, to include government in there. Government spending is such a different animal than private business investment or even consumer spending. but that's the way government has done it for many, many years, is to count consumer spending, business investment spending, and government as part of GDP, when government, in fact, crowds out, reduces the real job-producing part of the economy, the private business investment out there. And so that little two or three pages at the end of this chapter that I put in the syllabus really is worth reading and to keep these things in mind as you read or listen to the news about GDP and the growth of GDP, because you can have an explosion in government spending that will make the GDP figure look healthy. But what is really important is what has happened to private spending, private consumer spending, private investment spending. I think you'll find today, in today's economy in the U.S., we are in a depression still, if you just look at those components of the government's definition of GDP. And I see it's about 8:16. I think that's about what I wanted to mention for now. And I did have a couple of questions here somewhere. I can dig them out. I had two questions before the class. And you can feel free. I will also look at the Q&A, like I did last week, to see questions. But the first question that was on the list was by David Kramer. Let's see here. He says, Rothbard states that no government official regards himself as more than a transitory owner. He's secure in his property and owning capital value plans the use of his resources. He says the government official must milk the property as quickly as he can. And the question is the chief executive officer of a corporation also capable of milking the resources of a corporation X and then moving on to corporation Y? Well, there are very different institutions there. In government, yes, you cannot take government money at home. But government officials, of course, can shower themselves in perks and perquisites and set themselves up for a cushy private sector job by doling out subsidies to private corporations, like in the defense industry, for example, and then resign from the government and take $1 million or $3 million a year job with General Dynamics or someone like that. Yeah, they can milk the government in that way. Now, in the private sector, of course, who would hire a CEO who is known to have milked or plundered his company into bankruptcy? The idea that a corporate CEO can be, one walking disaster like that, because these people are hired by boards of directors. Boards of directors who own a lot of stock in the company. Why would they hire somebody to devalue their stock, to destroy the company by milking it, as it is called? They wouldn't do that. And if they did hire somebody who did a good job at first and then changed his behavior and began milking the company, whatever that might mean, well, there's the market for corporate control to worry about. That is, any corporation that is not earning as much money as it could can be subjected to a corporate takeover. And how it and there's a whole industry of corporate takeover specialists who do nothing but scour the landscape for companies that are underperforming. And what they often do, for example, is to organize a proxy battle. They will gather groups of very wealthy investors and put together a lot of money and buy up enough shares of stock that they can take over the board of directors, fire the existing managers, and hire new ones. And so the market, the free market, takes care of that. And also, there's a market for management. How do you move up the ladder as a manager? Well, you don't move up the ladder in your career as a business manager by being a big screw-up who plunders the company for your own personal benefit. You make your way up the ladder by proving that you know how to make profits for the company. And you share in those profits because salaries and bonuses are always linked to profitability. To some degree in most corporations. And so if you aspire to move up the ladder within one corporation or to go on the job market and shop your services around as a business executive, your resume has to be the ability to make profits, the ability to manage an enterprise that makes profits. Just the opposite of what's in the question, the ability to plunder or steal from a corporation. So there's a totally different dynamic altogether. But of course, it's always easy to point to an individual screw up who seems to behave like this. But that is the exception that proves the rule in the market. It's easy to find isolated examples like this, but that's not the nature of things. It is the nature of things in government, however, because there's no profit and loss system in government. Let's see, another question I had was from Robert Williams. I want to know, are corporations entities that arise naturally in a free market, or do they spring forth from the state power? No, they don't spring forth from state power. Corporations are collections of individuals who cooperate to produce goods and services on the free market. It's not, they don't spring forward from state power. I don't think they spring forward from anything. That's basically what a corporation is. It's a collection of individuals who cooperate to produce goods and services. Now, many corporations do seek government power and government influence through what is called rent seeking, lobbying the government for special benefits, for subsidies, for regulations that harm their competitors and so forth like that. But the corporation per se comes from the free market. It came from the free market. If you really want to learn about this, get a hold of a book called How the West Grew Rich by Nathan Rosenberg and E.S. Birdsell, B-I-R-D-S-E-L-L, I think it's outspelled, as I recall. It's How the West Grew Rich. And don't read those silly articles in the Freeman by Sheldon Richman and other people. Let's see, I'm going to look for other questions here that we might have. A lot of statements here. Robert says, electoral politics seems a futile way to affect libertarian change. Well, that is certainly true. Electoral politics is sort of the government lets us pretend that we participate in elections, don't they? But the system is pretty much rigged, as I discussed earlier. Robert is thinking of the contrast between Andrew Carnegie and later U.S. Steel. I would recommend a book, The Myth of the Robber Barons by Burton Folsom, F-O-L-S-O-M. He talks about real entrepreneurs like Carnegie, James J. Hill, who built the Great Northern Railroad, who built these great enterprises on the free market without government subsidies. And then some of these individuals later on accepted subsidies, and then there were others that Burton Folsom writes about who were what he calls political entrepreneurs who used their political connections to make money and to grow their enterprises. For example, when the first transcontinental railroads in the U.S. were built, several of them were government subsidized. The Union Pacific and the Northern Pacific were government subsidized. They were subsidized per mile of track. But the Great Northern, which was James J. Hill's enterprise, was not subsidized. So you had a real free market entrepreneur in James J. Hill, and then you had what Burton Folsom calls political entrepreneurs in the other ones. And of course, James J. Hill's Great Northern was vastly more efficient than the government subsidized enterprises for all the reasons Rothbard gave last week and this week in the readings. U.S. Steel is not inherently a statist creation, a corporation. A corporation is not a statist corporation. If it seeks government subsidies, it is a recipient of government subsidies. But a corporation per se needs not be need not come from the state in any way. A lot of so-called corporations began as one-man outfits, or one person founds it, and before and after a number of years has 1,000 or 2,000 employees and decides to expand even further, he needs to sell stock and expand ownership and incorporate. And that's how he expands so that he can have 100,000 employees someday. Walmart began from Sam Walton riding around in a red pickup truck in Arkansas by himself. And then he succeeded and became a corporation, but it wasn't a creature of the state, it was a creature of Sam Walton. Eric wants to know, is there research on who actually ends up benefiting from subsidies? Well, yeah, there's gigantic research in economic journals. There, the Journal of Law and Economics has thousands and thousands and thousands of articles that have been published since the 1950s on this sort of thing, and there are other journals also. This has been studied to death, but you have to get into the academic literature. There's no quick website search that I know of that you can get into that. Some of the think tanks like the Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the Independent Institute have been publishing articles for years on various types of government subsidy programs. So you can search their websites and find all sorts of articles on subsidies of just about everything. They've been around long enough. Gerald has a question about the merit system or patronage. Well, last week Rothbard made the case that patronage is superior because of the fact that it replaces the bureaucrats every few years when there's a new election. Otherwise, you have sort of a caste system that's created of lifetime bureaucrats who therefore have no incentive to do anything but grab more for themselves and not even attempt or pretend to serve the public. And so Rothbard made the case in the readings for last week that a patronage system is certainly not perfect, but it's less imperfect than the so-called civil service system. Let's see, Gerald was talking about the merit system. Well, the government merit system is not really based on merit. It's based on politics. The teachers unions, for example, hate the whole idea of merit pay because the minority of teachers, well, look at it this way. Most of us are average in what we do, which means a relatively small amount or above average. But most of us are average. And so look at the politics of a teacher union. The majority of the members of the teacher union are average or below. Only a relatively small group is especially meritorious. And in their thinking, merit pay that goes to the small meritorious group comes out of their pockets. So the majority of the people would prefer to share the pay raise money equally and not allow merit pay. So you have to distinguish between an ideal world where God would be the one dishing out merit pay, strictly according to merit and nothing but merit, and the real world, where in government, politics determines what, quote, merit is, in big quotation marks. And so merit pay doesn't work in government. You might find a few isolated instances of people who do good things, getting bonuses, things like that, but politics pervades everything in government. And so that's why they don't have merit pay in most government, is that the unionized public sector doesn't like it because the majority thinks the money for the more meritorious is coming at the expense of the majority of union members. So we don't have much. It's only in the private sector where it is imperative to have merit pay to keep or maintain your best employees. If you don't do that, you lose them to the competition. And so only in a competitive private enterprise does merit pay really have any serious meaning. It can never have serious meaning in government. Let's see, question, John wants to know about questions about the European debt crisis and the efforts being made by the statists. Well, they've been rioting in Greece over this. The welfare parasites have been rioting since early this year, I think January, February, something like that. And so, it's going to force these governments to cut back on their welfare states, which is a good thing, which they have to do. I think that's what they're going to do, and the rioters will riot. But it's either that or totally go bankrupt and have more and more cross-subsidies from money taken away from Germans. I mean, the wealthier Germans are only going to tolerate so much plundering of them through taxes to bail out countries like Greece. There's not a bottomless pit of money in the wealthier countries in Europe any more than there is anywhere else. And so I think the statists have met their Waterloo in places like Greece. Let's see, Eric has a question about Fortune 500 CEO compensation. These statistics are often sort of play games with. A lot of these guys and gals get stock options as part of their pay package. And then the 1 year they cash in their stock option, they get a huge $20 million, and that's what makes news. They aren't paid $20 million every year. Some of them do dumb things like pay themselves a lot of money when their company is losing money, but that's the exception that proves the rule, I think, that there's a lot of turnover in the CEO business. The average only lasts about 3 or 3.5 years. And so, you see articles about them making huge amounts of money, but that's the game. You know, I've known a few corporate CEOs. I have a friend who was the CEO of the Coca-Cola Nestle company for several years. He went to engineering school, graduated from Georgia Tech at age 21, went to work for Coca-Cola, worked very hard until he was about 60, so almost 40 years of being a very hard, very smart manager, and he was rewarded with 40 years of work being away from his family, traveling all around the world, long hours at the office, and so forth, by being made CEO and being paid a lot of money. They pay him a lot of money because they want to encourage people, some people, to choose to live that life. Not everyone wants to live that life. It's not as though these guys have been playing golf 5 days a week and just kind of strolling along, and then they reach age 50 and are given a $20 million a year job. That's not usually how it works. That might be how it works in politics, where you can be elected president before you're 50 after writing your second autobiography, but not in the corporate world. And so, but there are also some interventions that help this out. I mentioned the market for corporate control or the takeover market. The government placed restrictions on this. Michael Milken, who went to jail in the 1980s because he had been raising huge amounts of money to finance corporate, to help individuals finance corporate takeovers. And as a result, revenge was taken, and he ended up going to jail for some arcane regulatory laws that no one had ever been charged with breaking before, and they sent him to prison for it. And so that was a clear signal by the state that, don't mess with the status quo with regard to corporate executives by making the market for corporate executives too competitive. Some states have also passed what they call anti-takeover laws that make it more difficult and costly for corporate takeovers to take place. And so that, of course, allows corporate executives to get away with more paying themselves large salaries, much larger than they would be paid on a free market. So we don't have a totally free market, but we don't have a totally rigged system either in this whole area. that makes a corporation distinct from a partnership? Well, corporations can raise stock, and once they raise stock, there's something called limited liability that if you go bankrupt, they can't take the house of the corporate homes of the corporate executives. But if you're a partnership and you've invested your own money in the business and you go bankrupt, the people who you owe money to can take your house, your private bank account, to settle their debts. But you're limited from that with a corporation. Eric wants to know if distribution is just because some of us are just lucky, and my answer is no, because the government will redistribute money according to politics and not any sense of justice. It will always give itself a healthy chunk of the money, and then wealthier people are always better able at influencing government than less wealthy people. So the less wealthy people who are not as lucky, they won't necessarily be better off, and we'll create a system that will exacerbate the welfare parasite system if we increase the amount of money we give to welfare. So, the fact that some human beings are just lucky, I think in no way justifies stealing their money at gunpoint, which is what government actually does really when it takes your money from taxes and handing it out to whoever it wants to. And of course, there's also the old saying that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And so let's not exaggerate the role of luck in the world either. Robert wants to know if taxes in Europe will decrease with a decrease in government services. Well, I hope they would. It depends on whether or not there's a movement, a libertarian-oriented movement that will pressure politicians to cut back on the taxes as well as the state. They cut back on services, and they end up, the economy recovers, and they end up rich with tax money. I can guarantee you they'll think of ways to spend that money. Let's see, I have one question here by Robert again. Why is the government continuing to rake in money if it isn't doing anything? Well, Robert, you would probably do the same thing, wouldn't you? If cutting back on services but raking in the money during the real estate boom, for example, in the U.S., the main source of tax revenue to local governments and many states is property taxes. So as property values increase, the taxes collected automatically increase without any politicians voting to raise taxes. It really was taxation without representation. And of course, if they take in more money, they could use more money to essentially buy votes to enhance their political careers. That's what politicians do when they provide services, so-called. They're buying votes. They're buying support for their own political careers. And making themselves popular. That's what they're doing. And so they really raked it in during the boom. And so they'll always use any excuse for money, and because it's good for their political careers. It's not necessarily good for the taxpayers in their areas, but it's good for them. And that's what the assumption I think we have to live by is that all human beings are basically driven by self-interest, including politicians. If you want to understand their behavior, ask yourself what is in their interest in maintaining their careers, and that's how they will behave. There's a question about management by objective concept. Let's see, Bob says, is it experience that this breeds short-term budget goals? Management by objective, the thing we talked about last week is that in a free market system, what a business manager has to do with his or her subordinates is to say, your job is to make profits as much as possible. If they say your job is to do something else, some other objective, that's how you get a promotion, that's how you get a pay raise, well, that person will do that. That person will pursue that objective. But the real objective should be maximize profits, make as much profit as possible. So if you tell people, give people some objective to reach, and tell them that their careers will be enhanced if they reach that objective, well, that's the system you're going to get. And so that is a, if it's done in government, I think it's just bogus. It's a bogus way of trying to pretend that government enterprises are kind of like a business, because there are some businesses that use management by objective too, or some nonprofit institutions. But in a business, it should be make as much profit as possible, however you can do it. You know, choose your own objectives, Mr. Local Manager, as long as you think that they will be the best objectives designed to reach your main goal of making money. For the shareholders and for everybody involved in the enterprise. I have no idea what happened to Howard and Warren Buffett, although I do know that Jimmy Buffett is a cousin of Warren Buffett. Eric wants to know if there's any way to get back these ill-gotten gains of people who've gotten money from politics. Well, yeah, I suppose there's a way. I mean, there have been revolutions in countries where people have confiscated the property of the political cronies of the dictator, or that sort of thing. But I wouldn't recommend violence and that sort of thing. So I guess not. I guess not. Let's see, how did the politicians ever convince people to allow them to levy property taxes? I don't know the history of property taxes. The first property tax was a national property tax that Alexander Hamilton was instrumental in getting passed. But then there was a tax rebellion over it in Massachusetts, and they eliminated that property tax, the national property tax, in the 1790s. And I'm not sure how the state and local governments persuaded people to go along with property taxation. I'm sure they made the fairness argument that the wealthier you are, the higher the value of your property, the more you should pay. That's called the ability to pay principle in public finance. It's as though we're saying Donald Trump should pay $100 for a loaf of bread, but you and I should pay only $2 because he's much wealthier than us. In government, that's what they use, the ability to pay principle. So I imagine that argument was probably made with the advocates of property taxation. If the property tax was abolished, there would be a huge capital gain effect everywhere, because the value of houses would skyrocket. You know, if the government really was serious about increasing housing values, they would not try to print more money by the Fed. They would cut or eliminate property taxes, because say you have a $1,000 a year property tax on a house, and then you increase it over time to $5,000 a year. Well, whoever buys that house now is strapped with at least a $5,000 a year tax bill. Therefore, they're going to offer you less money for that house. And the opposite works true. If they're only going to have to pay $1,000 a year in property tax, they will offer more money for your house because it's worth more. And so if the government did significantly cut or eliminate property taxes, would be a huge positive capital effect on the markets. But they're not going to do that, because the property tax revenue is primarily used to buy off the political support of the teachers' unions, which are the heart and soul of the Democratic Party in America. That's the main reason why we have the property tax in America today. Yes, Robert is a serf. Well, I heard Peter Schiff the other night on television saying that medieval serfs were only forced to pay 25% to the lords of the manor, whereas Americans are paying 35, 40, 50%, depending on your tax category, that is working Americans. So the average professional in America is paying a lot more in tax than medieval serfs did. Yeah, Alexander says, read Henry George about the property tax. Yeah, he was a famous one on that. Well, we're going to talk about taxes next week, and Rothbard does talk about the property tax in the readings for next week. So I don't want to steal too much of my own thunder for next week, but it is the Rothbardian analysis of taxation, which will cover the flat tax or the so-called fair tax. It'll cover the discussion of the so-called consumption tax versus an income tax, and so forth. And so, and the property tax also, we can mention that. And so if you do the reading, feel free to write down questions while you're doing the reading and then submit them on the Mises Academy website so I can have them in advance and can work up more detailed answers if I can, if I have time, and I can look around the web, for example, for articles. David Kramer, can I talk about Rothbard's view on participatory democracy? Well, it's discussed briefly in the last part of this chapter. He points out the contradictions in it, some of the contradictions in it, and he says, well, if you decide that that's the system you want, okay. He's not dogmatic about it in this particular chapter. Rothbard was an anarcho-capitalist, though, so he was not in favor of allowing people to vote themselves anybody's income for any purpose. And so his view on participatory democracy is that the system is largely rigged, and there are internal contradictions that he talks about in the chapter, such as would they allow us to vote out all governments? You know, if we had a proposition, let's abolish the local government, that would never be allowed, even though we're supposed to have the right to vote in participatory democracy. There are certain things that would never be allowed. As far as that goes. So it's really not as participatory as you would think. And of course, the system is rigged with gerrymandering and the expenditure of millions of dollars by incumbents on staff, for example, who are essentially taxpayer-paid campaign staff that enable them to defeat any challengers in Congress all the time. And so, we participate, but it's futile to a very large extent because of this in congressional elections anyway. As my old friend Robert Higgs says, his opinion is that the only reason the government allows us to have freedom of speech is that they know it doesn't really matter. They can do what they want, regardless of what we say. Rothbard would not oppose democracy, say, in a homeowners association, because when you join a group like that and they say we vote on things like what color to paint the building, it's voluntary. You don't have to join that homeowners association. You can live somewhere else. And so the litmus test for Rothbard would be, does it facilitate an act of aggression? And in the case of voluntary organizations like a club or a homeowners association, it's not an act of aggression because you always have the right to live somewhere else. You don't have to join that homeowners association. But with government, they force you to pay income tax with the threat of prison. They put you in a cage if you don't pay. Well, it seems as though the group is running out of gas here, and we've got a lot of questions being asked. I'm trying to answer them as fast as I can. But I guess we can call it a night. It's getting close to 9 o'clock, and we've run out of gas, it seems like, with the questions. So thanks again for participating. Thanks for all the good questions. I hope you learned something from the reading and from this week. And next week will be pretty interesting. It's taxation. And it's always election season, I guess. And so we'll talk about the fair tax and the flat tax and the property tax and the consumption tax, among other things, next week. The Rothbardian analysis of it. So have a good week, everybody.